The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
You know, over the course of his administration, the U.S. conducted more than 200 declared strikes in Somalia. It was an almost a 500% increase over the 8 years of the Obama presidency. So, you know, it was a massive change. And I think it's one of the key reasons that that this attack was carried out. You know, it's a key reason why a woman and child were then killed in the strike.
I'm Tyler McBrien, Managing Editor of Lawfare, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, November 13th, 2023. In August, the U.S. Africa Command, aka AFRICOM, reported that it had killed 13 al-Shabaab fighters in southern Somalia. Though the U.S. government said that it did not kill any civilians this time around, several past airstrikes have claimed innocent lives. In one notable example from March 2018, U.S. drone operators killed a 22-year-old mother, Lul Dahir Mohammed, and her 4-year-old daughter, Miriam, as they hitched a ride in a pickup truck with suspected militants. In a recently published article for The Intercept, Nick Terse offers an unprecedented account of the March 2018 strike, thanks to his reporting in Mogadishu and a secret Pentagon investigation he obtained through a Freedom of Information Act request. As Nick writes, "This is a story about misconnections, flawed intelligence, and fatal blindness. It started with bad cell service and ended with an American missile obliterating civilians the U.S. didn't intend to kill, but didn't care enough to save." I sat down with Nick, contributing writer at The Intercept, to discuss his piece, a postmortem of that fatal drone strike, and the wider context of AFRICOM's drone war across the region, from the Obama administration through the present day. We also discussed why this special operations strike cell, quote, "seemed like they did everything wrong," according to one American drone pilot who worked in Somalia. It's the Lawfare Podcast, November 13th, Anatomy of a Somali Drone Strike, with Nick Terse. You recently published a story in The Intercept, and I would love to start there. So first, what happened in late March 2018? And if you could introduce us to some of the characters in your story as we go.
Sure. Thanks again for having me back on. It's always great to be on the podcast. You know, this is it's the first ever Pentagon investigation of a drone strike in Africa, which we're publishing at The Intercept. And it's an inquiry into an April 1st, 2018 attack in Somalia that killed a young mother. Her name is Lul Dahir Mohammed, and her 4-year-old daughter, Miriam Shiloh Muse. They were civilians who lived in an al-Shabaab-controlled area, and they were at the wrong place at the wrong time. They caught a ride with some individuals, some of whom were part of the terror group al-Shabaab, and some like them were probably just civilians who made the mistake of getting in the wrong car. This is public transportation in rural Somalia is at a premium. So it's not uncommon for people to share vehicles. And they happened to be in a vehicle on the day that a months long U.S. effort at targeting a very low level individual in al-Shabaab came to its culmination. And they were killed in the process during a drone strike that was actually several missiles fired, a double tap strike, and they were killed in the last of the missiles.
And as I understand it, you were doing some reporting in Somalia. You spoke with some of the relatives of the victims in Mogadishu and others who are familiar with it. If you could describe briefly what
Miriam's brother Qasim found when he arrived at the scene shortly after the attack.
Yeah, Qasim Dahir Muhammad, her brother, Lil's brother, and the uncle of the four-year-old child who was killed, was the first person on the scene. He was actually en route to try and pick up his sister and his niece. And again, this is a fact of rural Somalia. Al-Shabaab has great sway over the telecom companies there and had switched off the phones, so they weren't able to connect by phone. And that's why Lil and Miriam had caught a ride in this vehicle. And word travels fast. After the drone strike, he actually heard the explosion. He wasn't very far away. And the telecom switched on the phones, and he was quickly apprised of the fact that that this vehicle had been hit, and he was frantically calling his sister, but her phone just rang and rang. So he found out where the strike had taken place, and he drove to that spot. And what he found was a vehicle that was on fire. The top of it had been smashed. There were four dead men inside. One young man who had been thrown from the vehicle, who he found on the road, but there was no sign of Lil or Miriam anywhere around the vehicle. He had to actually walk something like 200 feet up the road before he found them. And, you know, he found his sister in a tremendously mutilated condition. She was clutching her daughter. They were both dead. And he spent the next several hours. He had torn a portion of his clothing, what they call a mahwis in Somali or a sarong. He tore a piece off and began collecting fragments of his sister. And he did this for, I think, a couple hours, eventually having to turn the lights of the headlights of his car on to try and collect, you know, the remnants of her body. And he wasn't even able to, under the strictures of Islam, you're supposed to wash the body in a certain manner. But, you know, she was too terribly mutilated to do so. He had to actually just wrap her body, and he buried his sister and his niece that evening.
And I'm sure it's incredibly difficult to describe, but I thank you for doing so, because it's, as you know, important context when we get into discussions of blowback and, you know, the upshot of attacks like this. But one thing that I want to start out with is, as you mentioned, this Pentagon investigation that you were able to acquire and review offers a pretty unprecedented look into the anatomy of a drone strike in the Africa, you know, region under AFRICOM. From what you learned from the document itself, from interviews that you conducted with drone operators and others, can you walk us through that drone strike from the target development to the strike itself, and then any sort of, you know, reporting that the military does in its aftermath?
Yeah, so the documents refer to months long of target development, and it's not clear. There's the documents are heavily redacted. These are it's a secret investigation, an AR-15-6 of this drone strike, but there still is a lot that comes through. So it's unclear exactly how long they were following individuals in this car, but at least it had started months prior. And this was conducted by a special operations task force that U.S. officials won't name. They were watching live footage of this. It was a Toyota pickup truck. They refused to release that footage, but they have it. And you know, they watched this with you know, and scrutinized this video in real time, chronicling each what they call an ADM or adult male who got in or out of the vehicle, where they walked, what they did. And they logged these very minute details with a pretense of precision. But it really comes through in the investigation file that they never understood what they were seeing. You know, for all their technology, all their supposed expertise, what comes through in the file is that the Americans were confused. Some of them were very inexperienced, and they said this quite blatantly to the investigator. And, you know, in the end, they got even the most basic details of this wrong, like how many people were in the vehicle. You know, they couldn't tell a man from a woman. They never noticed that there was a child. And, you know, if they had noticed a woman, it may have affected their decision to strike. If they had noticed a child, it should have caused them to stand down. But these things never happened. And they mention in the investigation file that that at the end of this process, at the end of months of target development, that they were in an extreme rush to carry out this strike. Those the reasons for it don't come through in the files. But when I was talking with an intelligence analyst who knew about this incident, and I talked to a strike cell analyst and drone operator who worked in Somalia at about the same time, they both offered, you know, some clues as to why this may have happened, that there was a great pressure at that time to conduct strikes, that there were commanders of strike cells who carry out drone strikes at that time in Libya, in Somalia, in Yemen, who were competing for body count, that there had been new awards or devices for awards that were just introduced that that caused drone operators to compete with one another to try and get these awards or citations. And the drone operator that I talked with said that it looked like just about everything that could go wrong with the strike did go wrong. And, you know, he just thought it was completely unprofessional the way that this was carried out. You know, but he wasn't shocked by it. He said that this was the attitude that he encountered at the time when he was serving in Somalia.
Yeah, and I just want to dwell on one aspect of the strike itself that you mentioned, the fact that it was a double tap. You describe in your piece that somehow miraculously Lowell and Merriam survived the first strike and actually fled the vehicle, which is one of the reasons why they were found you know, hundreds of meters away, as you mentioned. What is the decision there in the Joint Operations Center? What are the drone operators actually viewing on their screens when they see this sort of figure flee the vehicle? And as you mentioned in your piece, there was a sort of instantaneous decision made to send in the second strike. Can you walk us through that process as far as you can understand it?
Yeah. I mean, there's really just an oblique reference at the beginning of the investigation file that mentions a sole survivor running post first strike, something along those lines. This is actually two people, Merriam and Lowell, running down the road, and they got about 200 feet away before they were hit. So it wasn't very long. It is shocking that they were able to survive that strike, because the pickup truck that they were riding in the passenger seat was hit dead on, and it killed all the other occupants of that vehicle. But yeah, somehow they survived and they ran down the road. Now, you know, I talked to some military lawyers. I talked to this the strike cell analyst, intelligence analyst. All of them were sort of incredulous that that this could happen. That there seems to be no assessment that was done after the first strike as to who might be running down the road. The drone pilot that I talked to, who had extensive experience in Somalia, said that, you know, as long as the strike was during the day, which this was, there should have been no question that this was at least a woman running down the road, just from her dress. She was wearing a jilbab, which is it's a more voluminous Islamic garb than just hijab. Covers the entire body except for the head and the hands and the feet. And, you know, he said that that it was just impossible to mistake a man in rural Somalia for a woman. And this is also something that I heard from a Somali official named Noor Gatali, who serves on the front lines of the conflict, has worked with U.S. Africa Command, worked with the U.S. military before, provided them with intelligence. But he was just... he was really beside himself. He couldn't believe that that the Americans could mistake, you know, a woman for a man, and said that even if they had missed this when she was entering the vehicle, which they had eyes on through the drone footage, that there was no way, as she was running down the road, that they could mistake her for a man. So this was just another instance of the U.S. getting it wrong and seemingly being in such a rush to get this kill that they mistook or failed to notice that this was a woman and a child.
And what was the immediate response from the U.S. government in the aftermath of the attack? What was the first mention of it, let's say, from AFRICOM? And then I should also pause at this point and ask what the U.S. government's response has been to your questions regarding the story, if anything.
Yeah. So immediately after the strike, the next day, AFRICOM issued a press release that said that they had killed five, and this is their quote, terrorists, and that that no civilians had been killed in the attack. But, you know, Somali sources, Somali media, almost immediately contradicted this and said that that civilians had been killed. There was definitely a woman and a child. You know, they mention they had the names of those who were killed in the reporting right afterward. It was pretty extensive and very, very detailed information there. And these allegations did bubble up to the task force that conducted the strike. And within a month, they had, they had appointed an investigator. And by the end of, the strike took place in April. The investigator was named in May. And the investigator had finished his work by late June of 2018. And concluded that that a civilian woman and child had been killed in the strike, but this wasn't reported to the American public, to Congress, until well over a year after the strike. And AFRICOM officially said that that they weren't informed of this investigation, that it was conducted by the task force, and that the task force had just kept hold of the investigation and never sent it to AFRICOM headquarters. Now, I heard some things during my reporting that made me doubt this, but this is the official line from AFRICOM. And AFRICOM talked to me about this strike right after it happened when I had questions in 2018. But during the reporting of this article, which has been, over the last year that I've been working on this, AFRICOM did not provide answers to any questions that I asked about this strike in particular, or even about civilian casualties in general, and about how investigations are carried out. They told me that they had no comment on any bit.
And focusing on the report now itself, first, I'm curious how you were able to acquire it. I think you mentioned it was through a FOIA request, and I'm curious whether it was an especially arduous one compared to your past reporting. And then, the report itself, you mentioned a few of the findings, including a significant lack of experience among the strike cell team. But I'm curious, what else the report said, if it found fault in any of the operators, if it made any recommendations, anything like that.
Yes, this was obtained through the Freedom of Information Act, and it was especially arduous. I think I had to file the request several times to get them to act on it, appeal it. Yeah, one appeal of it, and it was a real FOIA fight to get a hold of this. I was pleasantly surprised by how much of the investigation file was there. Again, it's heavily redacted, but there's enough that gets through. Obviously, that I was able to write this article, and while a lot of the minute details and obviously the names of the individuals involved and even the name of the task force, any of the video footage, the snaps, as they call them, the outtakes of the footage, snippets of it, all of that is redacted. But the investigation, there's enough that there to really get a sense, one, of how strikes are carried out in Africa at this time, and also of all the many faults that were involved in this. As you said, I mentioned that inexperience was something that came up a lot in the file. The investigator mentioned that there was that the strike cell wasn't using the latest software that was available for analysis. There was, you know, an argument with between strike cell members about how many individuals were in the vehicle on the day of the strike. They never got that number right. And even in the post-strike review, when they had their most senior, most experienced full motion video analyst, the person that spent about 10 years watching drone footage, even watching again and again, he never got the number of individuals in it right, even through all this post-strike analysis. So it really casts doubt on how precise the U.S. air war can be and what precision strikes really mean. You know, this all comes through in there. At the end of the day, though, even though the investigator found that a woman and child were killed, that the team didn't see them, that you know, they never saw a child, that they miscalled a woman, an adult male. At the end of the day, they said that the rules of engagement in the strike were followed, that there was they found that all the standard operating procedures were the same as for any strike, which is frightening on a lot of levels. And they didn't sanction any individuals. All they said was that basically that there should be a briefing before any other strikes to let the team know that precision was more important than speed. But there's no indication that actually that was passed on or acted upon in any way.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com. A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. I want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers and that the one with the most information about me was called HLEC. I have no idea what HLEC is. So the other day, I got my latest report and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there. And these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back.
And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code lawfare20.
And, as you mentioned, despite these findings of lack of experience and so on, the report found that the rules of engagement were followed. So I want to pose a question that I believe Miriam's father posed to you, which is, how can you admit that you killed two civilians and also say the rules were followed? I guess, in other words, what were the rules of engagement in 2018 under the Trump administration? And was this, for example, just a permissible amount of collateral damage in the eyes of that administration? What was the context at the time of the Trump drone program, especially in Somalia?
Yes, this isn't in the investigation file, but in the course of my reporting, I really delved into, what the rules of engagement looked like. And there had been safeguards in place under the Obama administration. Still, civilians were being killed, but there were more stringent rules at that time. And they began to evaporate once Trump took office in 2017. And it really looks like their absence was felt across Africa and the greater Middle East. You know, just days after Trump entered the White House, the Pentagon, Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis at the time, reportedly asked for parts of Somalia to be declared an area of active hostilities. And that phrase really means that the military is able to employ looser war zone type targeting, despite the lack of a congressional declaration of war. The AFRICOM commander at the time, General Thomas Waldhauser, he was lobbying for this publicly. And he said that it would give AFRICOM the type of flexibility and timeliness that it needed to conduct strikes. Obviously under international law, governments can't, outside of recognized battlefields, summarily kill people they deem to be enemies if they don't pose an imminent danger to human life or can't be stopped in some other fashion. But Trump, secretly issued rules for counterterrorism, what they call direct action operations. So drone strikes, ground raids that gave military commanders on the ground a lot more latitude, the type that Waldhauser was asking for. And you can see this in a redacted copy of Trump's these targeting principles that were released in the early days of the Biden administration as a result of, I think it was an ACLU lawsuit. So, by the end of March 2017, so about a year before this drone strike took place, a large swath of southern Somalia was designated a de facto war zone. And in the year that followed, the number of drone strikes skyrocketed. I talked to the head of Special Operations Command Africa at that time in 2017. He saw as a general, Brigadier General Don Bolduc, and he saw this changeover from the Obama administration to the Trump administration. And he said that the burden of proof, as far as who could be targeted and for what reason, just dramatically changed. And I heard the same thing from the strike cell analyst, who had also been a drone pilot there in Somalia. And he said that during the Obama administration, you know, strikes required a very high level approval. But he said that giving that strike authority to ground commanders was massively different, and it had a huge effect upon, you know, how the drone war was waged. In that first year after Trump relaxed the targeting principles, attacks in Somalia tripled. And, you know, over the course of his administration, the U.S. conducted more than 200 declared strikes in Somalia. It was almost a 500% increase over the 8 years of the Obama presidency. So, you know, it was a massive change. And I think it's one of the key reasons that that this attack was carried out, and that, you know, it was so faulty in its design. You know, it's a key reason why a woman and child were then killed in the strike.
You've done a great job taking us through those changes from the Obama administration to the Trump administration. Now I'm curious about the change to the Biden administration. As I'm sure you know, and I'm sure many of our listeners know, the Biden administration issued new rules for the drone program, purportedly tightening some of these limits that were loosened significantly under the Trump administration, as you well laid out. So I'm curious, you know, what to make of the Biden administration's winding down of the drone program. I guess my question would be, could this same mistake or this same civilian death by drone strike occur now under the Biden drone program?
Well, I think, you know, the Biden guidance on drone strikes, it seems to be to mirror the Obama era rules from what we can tell. And certainly the strikes have decreased. The Biden administration has conducted about, I think, 31 declared strikes in Somalia since he came into office, about 13 so far this year. You know, I think the Biden rules, like the Obama rules, have a clause in there that includes a near certainty that civilians won't be injured or killed, slightly tightened over the Trump language. So, you know, I think on that level, I mean, there's just, you know, far fewer strikes being carried out. So there's less of an opportunity for this to happen. But if you know, examining this document, I think the same type of mistakes can be made, because what comes through is that, you know, one, this is the way that all drone strikes were basically carried out, that it followed all the standard operating procedures and rules of engagement, and that you know, the U.S. analysts just did not understand what they were seeing. You know, they weren't able to evaluate that full motion video and understand exactly, you know, what was happening before their eyes. The fact that they couldn't see a woman, or they saw a woman but thought it was a man, that they completely missed a child. That tells me that that, you know, U.S. Precision targeting is not that precise, and that watching full motion video is not foolproof. So, you know, I think the same thing can happen, but with less strikes, there's less of an opportunity for these mistakes to happen.
Right. You know, as you mentioned, any drone strike carries the risk of a civilian death, which seems, you know, reason enough to dwell on this. And but on the other hand, you know, I think as you laid out in your piece, there was a statement by Defense Secretary Austin who said that there's no plan to or no intent to relitigate cases. So, you know, I'm sure as the Defense Department would like to look forward, the Biden administration with its new rules, I'm sure would like to look forward. So what are the other reasons for revisiting this episode from 2018? I'm sure it obviously still matters a great deal to Lowell and Miriam's family, for example, but, you know, what are the impacts of leaving an episode like this as it was, or, you know, unaccountable?
Yeah, I think, I mean, one reason to revisit it is that the current Republican frontrunner is Donald Trump. I think there's a strong possibility that he'll be the nominee, and you know, could be reelected again. So the targeting guidance could certainly change in the very near future back to what it was when he was first in office. So I think that's one reason why this matters, and understanding how strikes were carried out, you know, during the Trump administration is still relevant. And for the reason that you mentioned that it matters to this family, you know, the U.S. Claims, you know, last year it the U.S. came out with a civilian harm mitigation plan, the so-called CHMRAP, and you know, the U.S. said that it was going to turn over a new leaf in its drone strikes and the way it looks at civilian harm, way it investigates, the way it makes reparations. And you're right, Secretary Austin said that they weren't interested in relitigating, but this case doesn't require relitigation. Before Austin said that, the U.S. had come out and said that that civilians were killed in the strike. So there's no relitigation necessary. They've already acknowledged that this happened. The documents that I have and the story that I tell show that, you know, this is a very clear case where, you know, the Pentagon made grave mistakes. And, you know, experts that I talked to said this is also the perfect, maybe the best opportunity in Africa for the Pentagon to show that it's interested in revising its civilian harm principles, that this is you know, the best possible case to reach out to a family, to make an apology, to offer compensation, and to show that, you know, it's the dawn of a new day at the Pentagon. The family has been attempting to contact AFRICOM now for 5 years. There is an English-speaking member of the family who lives part-time in Mogadishu. He's gone to Somali government ministries and asked them to intercede. He wrote to AFRICOM through their Contact Us page just after AFRICOM acknowledged the strike in 2019. AFRICOM put in a civilian casualty portal, which, you know, it's really, it's not set up in any kind of way that's conducive to Somali victims or survivors to put in requests. But I think he's one of the few who navigated the whole process and put in a request for compensation through that mechanism. He actually shared screenshots of it with me, showed me when he sent these into AFRICOM, the letter that he sent. They've tried every channel available to them to try and get the U.S. military to go beyond just acknowledging that this took place, but to, you know, to go that extra step and actually offer an apology and some sort of reparations. You know, it's my hope that this story can put this back on the you know, the front burner for the for AFRICOM, for the Pentagon, and help this family maybe achieve some measure of accountability.
Right. So as you mentioned, Miriam's family has received, you know, no official apology, no compensation of any kind, no reparations. What is the normal compensation reparation process? I think you mentioned in your piece that the Department of Defense maintains a $3 million annual budget for compensating civilian victims of drone strikes. Have other families who have suffered similar deaths in their family been able to successfully secure compensation, or is this a pretty typical experience?
It's unfortunately a very typical experience. You know, as you say, the Pentagon has a $3 million annual budget to compensate survivors. There's no evidence that any Somali victims or their families have ever received amends. I've asked the Pentagon about this. I've asked AFRICOM about this. You know, neither has offered you know, any information in that regard. We know from the New York Times, Asma Khan, who's done extensive reporting on the U.S. air war in Iraq and Syria, that, you know, out of, I think in her reporting, something like 1,300 military reports of this type she analyzed, and I think there were something like a dozen or less condolence payments that were made. So they have been paid out in the Middle East before. I don't think any have ever been paid out in Africa. Certainly none have ever been announced. But this does offer an opportunity for the Pentagon to finally make amends in one case.
And in addition to the family hopefully securing some sort of apology or compensation, which seems a worthy enough reason to undertake this reporting, I'm curious what else you hope comes of this. I'm thinking particularly, you know, in terms of transparency into the drone program, for example. It seems remarkable that this is the first inquiry that's been made public, thanks to your Freedom of Information request, into a drone strike in Africa. What else do you hope is an upshot of this reporting?
Yeah, I really am hoping that it just shines more of a spotlight on U.S. air war program in Africa. Like so much of U.S. military inactivity in Africa, you know, it's gone underexamined for many years. You know, I'm hopeful that shining light on it will, you know, open up a few more avenues. It was very difficult to get people to talk for this story. There's so much secrecy surrounding the program, but I'm hopeful that exposing what I have will help to, hopefully get some other people to come forward and talk about their experiences conducting the drone war there. I'm hoping that it will, you know, spur some other reporters to also dig into this further. It's a subject that has just gone undercovered and basically uncovered in many respects for a long time. And, I'm just hoping to spur more transparency, more accountability, and use this as another way for Americans to have some insights on what the U.S. military is doing in their name in these undeclared wars, you know, around the globe.
Well, it's an important piece, and I thank you for your reporting. Nick Turse, thanks again for joining me on the Lawfare podcast.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare material supporter through our website, lawfaremedia.org/support. You'll also get access to special events and other content available only to our supporters. Please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Look out for other shows, including Rational Security, Chatter, Allies, and The Aftermath, our latest Lawfare Presents podcast series on the government's response to January 6th. While you're at it, check out our written work at lawfaremedia.org. The podcast is edited by Jen Patia Howell, and your audio engineer this episode was Kara Schillen of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.